The Rock and Roll Coffee Show is brought to you by Writers and Rockers Coffee Company, keeping the music and memories alive with some damn good coffee. Visit them at writersandrockerscoffee.com. And Retroactive, located at Broadway at the Beach in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. 70s, 80s, 90s retro. ShopRetroactive.com. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Rock and Roll and Coffee Show. I am Joe Sebelia. My next guest is Rob Hammersmith. Rob is the drummer for the band Skid Row. I discussed with Rob their new singer, Eric Gronwell, and the energy that he brought back to the band. We discussed the filming of the new Tear It Down video, as well as future tour plans. And we also discussed a little bit of Tommy Lee. It was a great conversation I had with Rob. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Let's talk about the band, because you guys are on fire right now.
Dude, you know what? Thank you for saying that. We're having a great year. And obviously we're incredibly grateful for that for a handful of reasons. The last couple of years being the obvious reason. We're just so grateful and happy to be back to what we consider to be a full schedule. We're a little bit less than, in terms of shows, we're just slightly under our average going back a few years ago. But we're pretty much back to a full schedule. We've got plans. We've got a few U.S. dates starting in September. Mm-hmm. We'll be in the U.S. throughout September, early October. And then we head over to the U.K. and Europe. And then we'll finish out the year in Australia for a handful of shows. So for us, things are moving forward full speed ahead, which, like I said, we're incredibly grateful for that. So the new record will officially be out October 14th. Two singles have already been released. There will be another single between now and October 14th. Unfortunately, I don't have an exact date for you as of right now for that single. So right now, like I said, it's full steam ahead.
Do you know which song, or can you say?
I cannot say. I do know. Okay. But that's a closely guarded secret. Yeah, and that could change. You know, that's it's one of those things that nothing's carved in stone until 5 minutes after it's happened. It could go either way. So.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the album, because you got Eric in the band recently, not too long ago.
Correct. Correct.
I gotta say, Rob, you know, I think that was the best thing you guys could have done.
Yeah, it's been amazing. And I'm incredibly grateful. We've had such a great time working with him. Anybody who's done anything like this, or really with any job, it's the on the job performance, but it's the personal connection that you have with people, and all of that is a factor. And he's been an absolute pleasure to work with. Everybody's having a great time. It feels like there's kind of a new energy.
New energy. Yeah. I was gonna say that.
Yeah, and it's nice to know that comes across. We feel it as a band. And we know how we feel about the things that are happening, but you sometimes wonder if that really translates, if that comes across. And it seems as though it is. And we're all very excited about the future for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, the songs are fantastic. And from what I've seen, live shows just on YouTube have been amazing. I mean, the energy is back. The energy from Skid Row is back, I'd say.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Now, when you were recording this album, was it finished with ZP's vocals on there or no?
Yeah, it's looking back on it, there was a long process for us as a band, and for your viewers and your listeners who've been following the band over the last couple of years, they know that we've been working on this record for a long time. So there were multiple reasons, the pandemic being one of them, our busy tour schedule being another reason. There were several reasons why it took us longer than we wanted it to to come to completion. So to say it was fully recorded with ZP, I don't know that it was ever fully recorded until the day we said, okay, it's done. This is it. Sure. This is the record that we feel good about. I feel like we were probably close to being done a couple of times, but it was never entirely done. And you know, you've played in bands and being a bass player and being an artist and being creative, you know, sometimes as an artist, you get so close to something, sometimes you don't know when to call it done. Sometimes
it can never be done.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So we had some with Nick Raskulinek, our producer, and some with Eric coming in and kind of having a different perspective on some of these songs that have been recorded and some things that have been re-recorded and rewritten. And we took a lot of songs that we've had for a couple of years. And when I say we ripped them down to the studs and started from scratch, it was, that was really part of the process for us. Sometimes throughout that process, you lose the ability to really listen objectively. And sometimes you just lose sight of what the target actually is. So for us, that was a long process as artists and as musicians, and that was part of it. I know that's a long answer to your question, but I don't think it was ever really done until the day we all decided, okay, this is for better or for worse. We knew how we felt about it, but that moment had not happened prior to that final day.
Mm-hmm. And from what I know, past Skid Row, I mean, Rachel and Snake write the majority of the songs, correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay. And now on these songs that are out, you had other writers on them, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We had some help with some outside writers, and that's not brand new to Skid Row, okay. But you're exactly right. That's primarily the way the band has operated. And it's been that way since day one, since 1986, these guys have been, you know, Snake and Rachel have kind of been the core of the songwriting process. That said, there's always room for input from any one of the guys in the group. And now recently outside of the group, so yeah, it's been an interesting process seeing that unfold, and it was very good for us as a band, to be honest with you. Sometimes you need someone to kind of knock you back in your lane and remind you. Yeah, there are certain things that those guys do incredibly well. And sometimes as artists, you feel compelled to experiment and grow and evolve. And I think that's necessary, but sometimes you need somebody like maybe our producer Nick Raskulinek would remind those guys, hey, this is what you guys are great at. And don't lose sight of that. It's okay.
Right.
It's okay to own that. And sometimes you just need an outside perspective.
That's awesome. Well, I definitely think it worked from what I've heard so far. I think you're on the right track there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Are you a writer? Do you write?
You know, not in the official definition of songwriting does not apply to me. You know, I feel I do some things on my own creatively. I have some projects outside of Skid Row that I'm involved in creatively. As far as sitting down and writing a song from scratch, no, that's not something that I do. But I would like to.
Do you play another instrument or is it just drums?
I don't know. I just play drums. I say that, and I've told several people throughout the years. When I was a kid, when I was younger, I took a handful of piano lessons. And like most kids, I just was not into it at all. It was more of a chore than it was anything else. And this many years later, I wish I had stuck with it. And I know what you're going to say. Like everybody reminds me, it's never too late to go back and do that. And I know that at some point in my life, I would like to. I've kind of set some goals for myself and say that I'm going to go back and revisit piano. But at this point, the time that I allocate to music, I'm still the kid that fell in love with playing drums. I feel like I have a tremendous amount of work left to do with the drums. So when I'm fortunate enough to have time to allocate to music, it's either listening to music or it's playing drums that still motivates me.
How excited was Eric when you guys asked him to join? He seems like a very excitable guy, so I could imagine.
His energy, his enthusiasm is amazing. And he's a fan. He's a fan for sure, as was I when I originally started playing with the guys. So he was incredibly excited, and obviously that factors into the fresh start that I was talking mm-hmm. about earlier. He was definitely, and anybody who knows his personal story and some of his history over the last few years, it came at a very, very powerful time in his life, mm-hmm. and he had some health issues recently, and everything's great now. He's been a trooper. He's an inspiration. He pulled through some heavy, heavy things, and he has a very interesting story. So that all kind of came into the band with him. He has a very, very big personality. He has a very powerful personality. So to say he was enthusiastic and excited is kind of an understatement.
Did you record it?
I'm sorry.
Hopefully you recorded the conversation when you told him.
We did not. No. And you're the first person to say that, and looking back on it. Yeah, we really should have.
Yeah. How about you?
I think we were worried that he was going to say no. I didn't want to record. Yeah.
There's always that chance, right?
Yeah. We didn't want to record that. I don't want to sit around and relive that moment. So.
How about you? I mean, when you got asked to join the band, I mean, you had to be excited yourself. Were you a fan of Skid Row?
Absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. From day one, like most people from our era and certainly most musicians, and in the rock world, you know, I was definitely a fan. For me, it was a different process. I had known Rachel Bullen and I accidentally ended up in Atlanta, Georgia. Neither one of us was actually planning to move here and live here long term. He was aiming for Charlotte, North Carolina. I had no target whatsoever. I came here with the intention of staying for a few weeks. And that was 20 some years ago. So I just, that's a long story for another day, but we both accidentally ended up here around the same time and fell into the Atlanta music scene. So he and I, through mutual friends, we got to know each other, and we had worked together on some side projects, some things that he was doing outside of Skid Row and doing a little bit of recording. And so we developed a relationship, got to know each other, and had worked together on and off throughout the years. And he produced an album for a band that I was playing in here in Atlanta. And fast forward a couple of years after that, Skid Row had given my band the opportunity to open a handful of shows for them. So it was a very long process for me in doing all of these things. I one by one, I had met the other guys in the band, and they had seen me play, and they were all aware of me, but Rachel and I were really the ones that had an ongoing relationship with each other. And when they originally contacted me and approached me about doing some shows, it was originally presented as covering a handful of dates. And whether or not there was more to the story at that time, I wouldn't really allow myself to think past what is my job. I just need to do a good job and cover these shows. And if that's what it ends up being, so be it. And from there, that was over 12 years ago. So covering a few shows kind of took off for me. It was shortly after the first gig that it became known that there was the potential for that to be permanent. So things kind of went. So it was a completely different process for me. It was a long, slow process. It's really one of those stories in the music world, and you hear this from a lot of players and a lot of people who are in the situations that they're in. Sometimes you're always auditioning for something, and sometimes you don't know until years later what that is and what that looks like. And that was absolutely the case with those guys. Mm-hmm. So
now, for whatever reason, I thought you were in the Luchagors, but you weren't, right?
One show.
I don't know why I have this connection with you and them. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I thought that's where Rachel and you worked together.
No, and it's interesting. I did one show with the band, again, filling in and covering for their drummer. And I forget, I think there was a scheduling issue of some kind. And I loved that band. I loved the album that he worked on with those guys. So for me, that was a lot of fun. I would have loved to have done more, but it was a situation. I was just keeping the seat warm for somebody else. And I think it was a scheduling conflict of some kind, but that was so many years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's it's fun to relive that memory. I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, yeah. I remember that was like early 2000s, I want to say.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, because I was in a band communicating with Amy at the time. We were going to try and I was down in Florida. So
you were, okay.
We were going to try and swap shows, Atlanta and Florida, with them.
Gotcha. And gotcha. Now, you're in Myrtle Beach, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. For some reason, I didn't realize you were in Florida at the time.
Yeah. I used to live by Scotty, actually, when he lived down
there. You did? Okay.
Yeah. So we hung out a little bit. He used to come to my band shows every now and then. And we used
to hang out. Okay. Do you miss it down there? Do you miss it at all?
No. I mean, I lived most of my life there, so it was time. I left there to go to California, and then I was out there for about, I don't know, 5-6 years, and then work brought me back to the East Coast.
I got you.
So, but yeah, so now I'm in Myrtle Beach, and I like Myrtle Beach, except no bands come through here. I looked at your dates. You don't have any shows coming this way.
And it's frustrating because you have one of the nicer venues on the East Coast sitting right there, and we just, for whatever reason, the powers that be, for whatever reason, it just hasn't happened yet. But the House of Blues, Myrtle Beach, is one of the better rooms on the East Coast, and we just don't seem to ever make it there. So that's a shame. Well,
I don't know what's going on with them, but I heard that they don't want to pay. We've had a lot of opportunity with bands coming through, but they won't jump on it.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that sounds about right. So
yeah, it probably happens a lot, huh?
Yeah, it's the business side of things, a bunch of stuff that has nothing to do with playing music. So I try to stay out of that as much as I can.
Yeah, I hear you. There's a couple other smaller venues over here, but I mean, so who knows? Maybe you guys will get over here for a one-off show or something.
I hope so.
We just had Faster Pussycat over here. They did an in-store, actually, at Retroactive.
No kidding. Okay.
And that went well. So, you know, we've had
a few. That's great. Bands. That's great.
But yeah.
I do remember the in-store days. That's a... vaguely. It seems like a lifetime ago, right?
Yeah. Well, we're trying to bring them back over here. We've had them. We've had Resist and Bite featuring Tommy Skio from Tesla. His band came through. And we got some bands coming through in October. I can't really say yet. I mean, if you ever get this way, maybe we'll get something hooked up.
That'd be great.
Yeah. So back to you and your career. So you meet Rachel, you join the band. And Johnny was in the band at that time, I think, right?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Now, how long were you with Johnny?
So I've lost track of the timeline a little bit. I started playing, my first show with Skid Row was in April of 2010. And I've lost track when Johnny and the band parted ways. I'm going to guess 2015.
Mm-hmm.
It's either 14 or 15, but I'm going to say 15. And I don't know why that number sticks in my head. So Johnny and I were together for about 5 years, I would say.
Okay. And you did United World Rebellion Records?
That is correct. We did two EPs. Yeah, we did chapters 1 and 2 in that time period. And I've lost track again, the timeline. I don't remember exactly when. The first one was released. I believe the second one was in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And those were two EPs.
And is this new record? This is the first one since those?
It is. Yes. Yeah. We had plans to do a third chapter for the trilogy of the EPs.
I remember.
And then obviously that plan took a lot longer, and now this is kind of the completion of that plan, although it looks a little bit different and it's named slightly different. That plan has been in the works for a very long time.
Well,
I'm doing the math in my head as you and I are talking about it. It seems like doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but I guess it has.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to use a disclaimer. It doesn't see the last 2 years didn't count. So I think you could say that for a lot of things.
Right. Now, did you write this record during that time, the last 2 years?
A lot of it, yes.
Yeah.
Some of it, it's probably maybe 50-50 of songs and ideas that have been kicking around with the guys for a while. Some of them might be just a part or an idea. Some of them might be somewhat completed songs.
Mm.
We have a batch of songs that we recorded a couple of years ago back in, it was early 2020. It was right before things got weird and right before the shutdown. And some of those songs were carried over and reworked. And as I said, we spent a lot of time kind of just ripping everything apart and seeing what we liked, seeing what we didn't like. So yeah, it's probably 50-50 with stuff that carried over from those sessions. But those guys are always working on something, as we all are. We're all creative guys, and we all love doing what we do and playing our instruments. So those guys are all kind of, they're always stockpiling ideas and writing and working on things. So you never know when something's gonna grab everybody's attention.
Sure, sure. And then so after the pandemic, you came out and you, it's the Live to Rock tour, right? That you guys are currently on, you're finishing up?
That is correct. Yes. We have a handful of those dates throughout September and early October. And then we'll break away from that and finish the year overseas. So
How's that tour been going? It's with what? Quiet Riot?
It's been
Warrant.
It's been great. It's been, and Winger has been on a handful of the shows. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. You know, we have, with each of those bands, we have a long history. So as far as working together on a personal level, it's great. But we're fans of each other's bands, and it works well personally. The response to the tour has been great. So I have a feeling you're going to see some more of those dates being announced, but I haven't seen anything official as of yet. But it's been great. We really can't complain. Can't complain about anything. It's been a wonderful year.
Mm-hmm. And you did a video for your latest single, Tear It Down. Now, did you guys have to pay for that house demolition?
No, but man, that was an interesting story. So we were in New Jersey. And we were aware that we were filming a video. And then we found out that we were actually going to go on location. And it was pretty bizarre to actually be out there in the street. So we had local police were kind enough to, and this had all been prearranged, but we didn't really know until maybe the day before or the night before. So I was hearing bits and pieces of what the idea for the video was going to be, but I really had no idea until the night before that I was actually going to be sitting in front of a building that was being torn down just a few feet away. So that was a lot of fun. That was an interesting process for us. But no, to answer your question, we did not have to pay for that. They were going to tear it down whether we were there or not. So that didn't come out of our pocket, but it was fun.
They must have had to crank the song to hear it over all that noise.
It was an interesting process. When one of these days, I'll send you some behind the scenes footage.
I love that.
It was a pretty interesting process, to say the least. And I was so fascinated. Anytime you put a kid like me, I refer to myself as a kid. You'll hear that a few times throughout our conversation. Okay, so in my mind, I'm still an excitable little kid. You put me near a bulldozer or something like that, and all I want to do is figure out, okay, what's he going to do with this big piece of equipment that's sitting out here, and it's loud and there's smoke and there's all kinds of cool stuff happening. So it was actually hard for me to concentrate on the song and pay attention to what I'm doing, because I'm wanting to watch what he's doing.
Right.
So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Your drumming style, who influenced you as a drummer? Simple question, basic question, but.
Yeah, my biggest influences, a couple of them might be obvious choices, but I feel like they're obvious for reasons. But I would say for the longest time, Phil Rudd is probably the blueprint for, I say probably, he's definitely the blueprint for my approach to playing for a lot of reasons. And when I was younger, I'm a massive AC/DC fan, still am. And his drumming is obviously such a huge part of that band's sound. And for me, it's why it's one of the biggest reasons why I connect with their catalog of music. But when I was growing up and I was a younger player, when I was trying to figure the whole thing out, and I wasn't exceptionally disciplined as far as taking lessons and the formal side of learning how to play an instrument. And I say that, and this many years later, I wish I had been a little bit more focused on that side of it. But for me, it was really more of a social thing. It was really more about being in the garage with guys who were 2, 3, 4 years older than I was. And
sure.
And when you're a young kid like me, like that's huge. You think that's cool. And that's all I want to do is get in the garage and try to hack my way through Ramon songs and AC/DC songs and things like that. So when I started doing that, his style of drumming, although I wasn't listening as deeply as I do now, it seemed attainable to me. It seemed like those songs were something that if I worked at it and put some time in, that I could actually do that. It wasn't Rush. It wasn't crazy prog rock type of things. And I didn't really have that mindset as a younger player. And now this many years later, when I really listen to Phil Rudd's playing, it's obviously not as superficial and as basic as I thought it was as a kid. He has an incredible voice behind the instrument. He has a thing that he does, and to try to recreate that is virtually impossible if you're not him. But as a kid, that was kind of the direction I went in very early on. And from there, it was drummers like Simon Kirk from Bad Company. Mickey Curry is probably one of my, I say probably, he's definitely one of my favorite drummers of all time and top three. But as a kid, I didn't realize how many songs I was hearing or how many records I was listening to that it was Mickey Curry playing drums on. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of people realize until they start researching his catalog and his history and a lot of the major hit records that he was a part of. So he was a huge influence on me and still is. And then John Bonham, you have to, for me, he was definitely a big influence. He's an obvious answer, but I say that as a compliment. It's sure. An obvious answer for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I was certainly into the hard rock drummers of the day, the Tommy Lees and guys like that. I was certainly influenced by all of that stuff. But if you hold me down and ask for one name, it's going to be Phil Rudd for sure.
Yeah. Very underrated drummer. You don't hear his name.
I think enough. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how I feel. And it's really when you go through that band's history and their catalog and what made that band special, it was a lot of things, but I don't think you can really overstate his influence on the sound of that band. It's he's got a certain thing that he does, and I think a lot of us will be chasing that for years to come, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the Tommy Lee incident that people blew up about?
You know,
not the dick pics.
the dick pic. Okay. All right. Yeah, I guess you have to be more specific about what incident.
He's
yeah.
got a couple
are we talking about the? Yeah, are we talking about the ribs? Are we talking about the?
the hi hat.
Yeah. Oh, the hi hat. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
It's, and the ribs, but let's go with the hi hat first.
Yeah. So you know what? I watched an I'm going to say an analysis of it, and I think that that's a strong word, but I watched kind of a breakdown of it. I don't have an opinion. I don't know. If you really listen to it, and you and I can kind of be music nerds for a couple seconds.
Sure.
I don't really know what went down with the count in with the hi-hat, but if you listen to the first bar or two of that song when he comes in, there's a certain wobble to it that leads you to believe that there's a human being there doing something, and what the ratio of human to pre-recorded track is, I don't know. I think it got blown out of proportion. And I say that as a guy who has absolutely no insight as to what those guys are doing up there. So, I mean, who am I to?
don't a lot of drummers, I mean, I'm not a drummer and I've never been in a situation, but don't a lot of drummers in that situation use some kind of tempo kind of click to get songs started sometimes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, with Skid Row, we're doing that. And I call it Big Brother. And it's we don't use any pre-recorded tracks. But as far as tempo ranges and starting songs consistently, and players have been doing that for years. And that's, I think you're right. I think that's much more common than what people realize. Mm-hmm. You and I could do an entire episode on our thoughts about the tracks, but I think that's more common than people realize. And I think, I think people are eager to catch somebody having a hiccup or a glitch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like where your line is on what's too much and what's, I don't mind a little bit of gravy on the turkey. Right. So if you need a little bit of something to, if that's your band sound, if that's what you guys do, I do feel like it can be taken too far. With what I saw for that incident, I thought it was blown out of proportion, but
agreed. How about the ribs? Being a drummer, how hard is it to play with the broken ribs?
Well,
I don't know if you've ever had broken ribs, but
you know what? I have not. Thankfully, I've never had to do it. I that's another situation I don't have any insight on. So yeah.
I got to imagine it would be tough.
I have to imagine, and certainly playing the way he plays, mm-hmm. you know, he's in. So there's a lot of, the internet is just blowing up with all kinds of theories and things and accusations and explanations. And it's a whole thing that I don't have time to get into. I just, in my personal life, I don't spend enough time worrying about all that. But, you know, you'd be disappointed if he got up there and he didn't play the way Tommy Lee plays. So if you get four or five songs out of him, you know, I think that's great.
Things happen. I mean,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So. There's some speculation that wasn't even the cause of what was going on. And I don't say that to further that rumor. I'm just, you know what? I could sit here all day and repeat things I read on the internet, but I don't think that you and I want to do that. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what about, now your early childhood, was there music in your family?
There was.
Okay.
Yeah. Although not in a playing capacity. So my father, and I love telling stories about growing up in my house. My father was one of the biggest fans and still is one of the biggest fans of music that I've ever met in my entire life. But oddly enough, my parents don't play musical instruments. And my sister was very similar to myself. I have an older sister. She's 18 months older than I am. So we're very close in age. She was one grade ahead of me in school. Mm-hmm. She played in school band, but it wasn't something that she wasn't passionate about it. It was something that she did, but didn't really have the connection to it like I did. So I was the only real player in our house, but there was always music no matter what we were doing, if my dad was working in the garage, he was listening to music. If he was working in the yard, he was listening to music. When, you know, we grew up in the generation, it's, if you're in your dad's car, your dad picks the music. Mm-hmm. And there was always music being played in the house and at family gatherings, at functions and things like that. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I was being exposed to a ton of different styles of music and types of music. And as a kid, it just kind of seems like, I don't know if it's background noise or I think there's a certain obligation to, you probably went through the same thing, but as a kid, if it's your parents' music, you just automatically don't like it until you get to a certain point in your life where you realize, okay, well, this is actually really, this is the blueprint to all the stuff that I'm into. And this is really, really good stuff. But exactly. It took me a long time to figure that out. But my father, again, is a huge, huge, huge fan of music. So always music playing in the house.
Mm-hmm. Are you a music collector? Do you collect vinyl or anything?
I don't. No, I'm not a collector of No, I'm not a collector of much these days. I'm actually, no. I'm going through a weird phase in my life where I'm trying to get rid of so many things. And I don't know if I'm turning into a minimalist. Or,
that's the funniest thing. Okay. We have a box downstairs where every day we have to put something in it we're getting rid of because we just have too much stuff.
Yeah.
And then when it gets full, we take it, donate it, or sell something, you know, we just get rid of it.
Okay. That's an interesting way to, I haven't gone the box route yet, but we've done numerous basement purges. And when I describe this, it sounds like I've been a hoarder for all these years. But just things that I've gone through these phases of my life where I've convinced myself that I need these things and these things that I want and things that I felt like I needed. And I figured out that I really only care about maybe 25% of it, if that. And and it's been it's been kind of therapeutic in a lot of ways to just get things out of the house.
It's great.
Yeah.
Does that make us old?
I think that it does. I think that's
okay.
A sign.
That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm okay with that. I think that's a sign of growing up. Maybe it's part of this whole midlife crisis thing. I don't know. Who knows?
Well, it's a good feeling. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Are you a collector? I'd imagine that you're a collector.
I am. And that's part of the, you know, the wife hates it. I mean, I have, see that thing back there, that Funko Pop?
Yep.
I got about 250 of those in the attic I still haven't parted with.
Okay.
They used to be out, and she made me get rid of them, so they're in the attic, because I couldn't.
Gotcha. Okay.
But you know,
at least she didn't put them in that box that you were talking about.
No. But the good thing is, I got one. This one. Whoa. This little guy right here, Nikki Six.
Oh, nice.
He's worth like $200.
Okay. Well, there you go.
So, you know, when I get ready to get rid of them, maybe I'll sell them.
There you go.
So if you want to buy any Funkos, let me know.
All right. I'll definitely, Of the, I say collection, and I know that we're trying to stay away from that word. of the approximately 250, what's the most special, which one do you have the most attachment to?
Well, my Motley Crue's I like. I got all four of them. The others are up there. Okay. Just because that was my band when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But honestly, I don't remember what's up there.
Oh, okay. All right. Don't tell your wife that.
I need to pull them down and see. I gave my kids the Ghostbuster ones because they were in the Ghostbusters. So I had Ghostbusters. And they, of course, opened the boxes, ripped them open, and whatever. I never open them. I'm one of those guys. Keep them in the box.
Okay. So you're concerned about retail or resale value. Is that your thing?
I don't know. You know, it's like, it's only worth what someone's going to buy it for, right?
Yeah, so I got you.
Who knows if I'll ever sell them or not. They might end up at Goodwill. So,
So, it's funny when you asked me that question and talking about the basement purge and the things that we as a family have been going through and I say getting rid of, but whether we donate them or whether we decide to just toss them, that they're not really worth anything. Mm. It's amazing the things that I have collected throughout my life and at one time was so important to me. And then you just kind of wake up one day and you realize that I just...
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't have it.
You're not attached to it.
In any way, shape, or form. I just... Mm. I don't need it. I don't want it. It just takes up space. That, in a lot of ways, creates stress and anxiety. Sometimes it creates work and maintenance and these things that I'm not into single use items right now. I don't want anything that I'm only going to use once. And unfortunately, as an adult, you're forced to do that, whether it's tools or things for the yard or something. If you have a project in the house, you're forced to buy all these single use items and they sit there and they pile up. And I always go through this thing where I'm going to put it here. And when I need it again, I'll know exactly where it is. And I can never find it. I can never find all these things that I've kept in the basement. And I put all this time and effort into organizing. and I go through this whole process of putting things in this particular place. And in 2 years when I need it, I can't find it. So I buy another one. And then a week later, I find the first one. So.
Right. Do you have one drum kit?
I do. Well, I have... several And that's another category of equipment and gear and these things that I've accumulated throughout the years. And a lot of it I did need at the time, but it just kind of piles up over time. And I really, truly, I have my favorite kits. I have a couple that I love, and I have a couple of snare drums that I absolutely love. And I don't have anything that's necessarily, I don't think I really have anything that's considered collectible or valuable. I have some of my favorites, and I have some that are very practical and I wouldn't want to be without. But it's really 25% of the stuff that I've convinced myself throughout the years that I needed. And the one thing that I've really discovered about myself is when I was younger, I had these grand visions of, well, if I'm a busy studio player, I'm going to need all of these things. And I think that was true at one point. But nowadays I feel like you can accomplish a lot with, if you choose wisely and you kind of cover a few bases, I think you can cover a lot more ground that way. But that's something that took me a long time to figure out. And a lot of the stuff that I convinced myself I needed, it doesn't make me a better player. A lot of times you hear the stories, and I don't know who your favorite players are, but you oftentimes hear these stories of these players that'll sit down with a relatively inexpensive guitar or something like that, but when they play, it sounds like them.
Sure.
I read those stories, and that's kind of resonated with me throughout the years that there's a lot to be said for really good quality, good sounding equipment, but I don't think you need a basement full of it. I really just don't feel that way anymore. So.
Yeah. I got some hanging up, some basses and guitars. I got about 5 of them left.
Okay.
That I haven't got rid of. I figure that's a good amount.
Yeah.
4 what of them I never touch.
When you say 5, what are you down from?
I didn't have a whole lot. I had maybe about 8 to 10.
Okay. That seems reasonable.
Yeah. I still have my base cabinet, my Ampeg 810, which I have no reason to have that. So,
yeah. Okay.
You know, it's one of those things. It's like, do I get rid of it? I'm like, well, I might need it, but in reality, I don't need that thing.
Yeah.
But anyway. Yeah.
Do you have an emotional attachment to it?
No.
No.
It's in Florida.
It is. Okay.
It's at my old singer's house. Okay. So it's like, why do I even have this thing? But anyway.
Yeah.
What about motorcycles? I know you're into motorcycles. You have a few of those? No.
I'm down to 2. I'm down from 3 to 2. So that is something that I would probably be a collector if I had the resources, number one, but the space, I just don't have the space for any more than what I have right now. So, that would be something that could be potentially a bit of a problem for me, but
that could be dangerous, huh?
It could be. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you a street guy or dirt guy?
I'm a street guy, although I grew up on ATVs and dirt bikes and those types of things. But I would love to get back into that. I just don't really. There are a few areas near where I live that would be good for that. But I just, at this point, I don't have the space, number one. And it would really be a situation where I'd have to haul it back and forth to really get into some good riding. So I don't really have the energy for it right now. Yeah. So never say never.
Now, I know Rachel used to be into racing. Is he any of the other guys into motorcycles or no?
No, a couple of the guys have dabbled throughout the years. I think everybody in our generation, and maybe it's not a generational thing, I think we all went through a dirt bike phase, did we not?
Yeah, I mean, that's like kind of what you did as a kid if you had a place to do it.
That's exactly right, yeah. And for me, back in when I was a kid, the ATVs, the dirt bikes, those types of things, growing up in a small town, that was freedom. That was every bit as good as a car back then. And just, you kind of figure out, if I cut through this backyard and this field and through the back of the school property, and next thing you know, I'm on the other side of town. So that opened up a completely different world for me. And I look back on those days with a lot of really fond memories. And a couple of guys, same thing. They grew up and had their phases with that, but nobody's into it now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. So you got the new record coming out in October, you said, is that right?
October 14th. Yes.
October 14th. You're hitting the road. You're going overseas, not coming to Myrtle Beach.
No, not that I'm aware of.
Not right now.
No, hopefully next year. Hopefully.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Rob. Well, listen, man, I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Thanks for listening to me run my mouth. Yeah.
It was fun. That's how I like the conversations to go. You never know what we're going to end up talking about.
So. Awesome. Awesome. But, yeah. I love it. Well, thank you. Thank you again for having me. It was great.
Anytime, buddy.